Maine.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, first up, as we heard there on the NPR News, just to recap a big story, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who was overseeing Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into whether President Trump's campaign colluded with Russia to influence the 2016 presidential election, is expecting to be fired today, according to several news reports. Axios reported that he had already resigned today in anticipation of Trump firing him. Rosenstein's potential departure follows a report by the New York Times on Friday that in 2017, he'd suggested covertly recording the president in the White House and had discussed invoking the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office. We're going to open up the phones later on in the show and talk about that. But first, one listener comment about last Friday's program. Last Friday, we got into a discussion about the controversy surrounding Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. After the show, here's what one listener had to say.
My statement is in reference to the DeSantos and Gillum issue. I believe the reason that DeSantos, the Republicans, and even the moderate Democrats just don't get it. The reason I believe Gillum won is because most people finally realize that millionaires and billionaires do not represent them. And because of that, I think DeSantos is headed for a major beating in November.
Well, not the comment I expected to play. Well, coming up, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night. It's a public television program that I host. It features a roundtable discussion of Democrats and Republicans and journalists and professors, and we talk about the big issues. Today on this show, we're going to hear a discussion about the latest in the governor's race and the latest in the U.S. Senate race. That's coming up on Florida This Week right now on WMNF 88.5 FM. Coming up next, President Trump is reportedly angry at Florida Republicans who are not backing him on the Puerto Rico death toll controversy. DeSantis and Gillum roll out their plans for education. Protesters harass Governor Scott during his bus tour, and questions raised about the work schedule of both U.S. Senate candidates. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
From the WEDU studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. This week, our panelists are Amy Holyfield is the deputy managing editor for politics, metro, and business at the Tampa Bay Times. Mitch Perry is a reporter for the FloridaPhoenix.com. Chris Ingram is a host on Bay News 9 and Radio AM 820 News and a Republican. And Ione Townsend is the chair of the Hillsborough County Democratic Executive Committee. Well, thank you for coming. Nice to see you. Well, the website Politico reports that President Trump has been privately criticizing Florida's Republican gubernatorial nominee Ron DeSantis after the congressman disagreed with the president over the official death toll in Puerto Rico. DeSantis owes his nomination to Trump's early endorsement and also to millions of dollars of free airtime on Fox News. But after the president publicly disputed the 3,000-person death toll from last year's hurricanes in Puerto Rico, DeSantis joined Democratic and Republican lawmakers in disputing Trump's comments, saying he does not believe the loss of life was inflated. The president thinks the death count was exaggerated by Democrats to make him look bad. Politico reports the president thinks DeSantis has been disloyal, and one source describes the situation as a divorce. DeSantis is locked in a tight race for governor. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum leads DeSantis by less than 4 points, according to a Real Clear Politics average of polls. So, Amy, how serious do you think this is? Politico is reporting this. Really, only a few other outlets have picked it up. Do you think that this is a serious problem for President Trump and Congressman DeSantis?
I can't really tell right now. My guess is no.
I can't imagine that this is a divorce between Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump, given how important Florida is, given how tight this relationship has been and gone back. This is an important issue, Puerto Rico, for Florida, and especially for Ron DeSantis when he's trying to be Florida governor. So I can see it as maybe a place where he's comfortable setting himself apart from the president because it's so important to him to get this part of the electorate that we've been talking about all year as being important to this vote. But I kind of can't imagine the president isn't going to still come down here and do an event for Ron DeSantis. I can't imagine he's not going to tweet about him again. I think this is probably a situational disagreement that will get passed.
That will really be the sign if he comes down to campaign that this is just a minor problem, if it's really a problem. Right,
I would go a step further than Amy, and I'd say this potentially is calculated and orchestrated in order to give DeSantis the room to say, hey, I'm not Trump's guy all the time, and I will take him on when necessary. You always want to run a little bit more to the center in a general election. I think that this is the perfect setting for that, for him to establish, I'm not just Donald Trump's guy. But all these Republicans who are backing down from the president's statements about Puerto Rico, I think they have a very calculated political decision that they've made, and they recognize the importance of Puerto Rican voters. But I actually believe that the numbers, while not inflated as I think the president might have suggested, I think that the fact that we went from 100 or so, whatever it was, then all of a sudden it's 3,000. I just don't buy that you can reasonably attribute all of those deaths, 8, 9, 10 months later, directly to the storm. Indirectly, yes. And so I do think that there is something to be said for the president challenging those numbers.
So the Democrats may be, you think, inflating the numbers.
Well, again, I don't want to say inflate. I think that the calculating these numbers, and it was a calculation. This was not a body count. Mm-hmm. This is a calculation, and I think that coming up with numbers of people that died, you actually have bodies and you count them. You don't just use art and estimate the number of people that died from something that happened 12 months earlier.
This is a calculation that has been used for many other events going back to the 1960s. You're talking about a country that was decimated and didn't have medical records. There was no way of getting an accurate death toll from the methods we would normally do it. And so the research that was done by George Washington University was tied to other disasters that have happened that they've had to do this with going back to the 1960s.
I was just going to say, it's interesting take that Chris says that it was calculated, perhaps, but it's also the non-surprising story of the week. When Donald Trump is okay with somebody criticizing him, that would be news, right? The fact is that it's interesting, as Amy said, though, the question is, the acid test is, does Donald Trump come down here and campaign for DeSantis like he did back in the primary? And he has to for Ron DeSantis. I think the calculation's a little different from Rick Scott, in terms of the election, the campaign they're running. As you said in the setup, Ron DeSantis owes so much to Donald Trump, and I think he needs to get all the hardcore voters to go to the polls in November, and that means having Trump strongly behind him. Rick Scott, on the other hand, who also criticized or, said, I disagree with the president on that tweet, has been running a different campaign and trying to be way more general election friendly, if you will, because even though he's known to be a close ally of the president as well, but he doesn't seem to owe his victories to Donald Trump as Ron DeSantis does.
Mm-hmm. It does show, and Chris said this, it does show the importance of the Puerto Rican vote here in the state of Florida. Is that vote locked into the Democratic Party, or is that kind of a mixed vote, do you think, with a million people of Puerto Rican descent living here in Florida?
I think it is a mixed vote, and I think in terms of the people, the wave of people that has come to Florida since the hurricane is difficult to measure. They're difficult to find. There's a lot of attempts on both sides of the spectrum to find these folks and get them registered to vote. It's interesting, the polling data shows that this population is very anti-Trump but pro-Rick Scott. And so, it makes you wonder, do they not know that Rick Scott was on President Trump's transition team, mm-hmm. and that he's been closely tied to Trump. So it'll be interesting to see in the end, the final analysis, how many of those people we've been able to find and register.
Doesn't a lot of it boil down to the perception of the chief executive and how well they helped the hurricane recovery, whether it's Jeb Bush or Barack Obama, President Bush, or Rick Scott, or now President Trump.
And I want to play something else she said, and also Mitch. I don't think that we're going to see Donald Trump back in Florida before our election day in November. I think that DeSantis is very calculatingly going to stay away from Trump, try to run to the center, maybe even get some other surrogates in the state that are more mainstream and centrist within the Republican Party to soften the image or the perception of Ron DeSantis as being an ultra-right-wing conservative.
Some of the poll numbers suggest that President Trump is underwater here in the state of Florida in his approval ratings, that his disapproval rating is about 49, his approval rating is about 41. So would that be the reason why President Trump stays away?
Well, I mean, they're obviously going to be looking at the polls, but I also think that a lot of conservatives are not paying so much attention to the public polls as this year as they may would have in the past. I can't tell you the number of times I speak to conservatives that say they get polled and they give misleading information when asked by the pollsters because they're just trying to throw them off and they don't trust what's being done. And so, you know, I just think, yeah, if the public polls are showing that Trump is underwater, that just gives further reason for DeSantis not to bring President Trump in, but I don't think that's what they're making their calculation
also on. In the polls, Puerto Rican community, I would say overall, was not happy with President Trump in terms of how he handled Maria last year, but interestingly enough, I don't know about the Puerto Rican electorate, but Hispanic polling has shown that Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis are leading their Democratic rivals right now, which is a bit surprising, even with the conservative, you know, the Cuban vote.
Well, does that speak to the size of the Cuban-American vote?
It still does, but you would think, we know that that Cuban vote has been changing. It's not a solid, rock-solid Republican vote as it has been in generations past, and yet, so that says something about both Gillum and Nelson having to do more work with that community.
Okay. Well, Florida's two major party candidates for governor both announced their plans for education this week, and the two plans are quite different.
Republican Ron DeSantis wants to expand the state's private school voucher program, and he wants to spend more on classrooms by making cuts in other parts of the education budget. He also wants to take a closer look at the content of what the state is teaching in schools. Democrat Andrew Gillum, meanwhile, wants a $1 billion increase in the state's corporate income tax. The Tallahassee mayor wants to use that extra money to pay teachers more, as well as to spend more on early childhood programs and on vocational training. Gillum does not support an expansion of the state's voucher program for private schools. The winner in November will replace outgoing Governor Rick Scott.
So, Mitch, what do you make of these competing plans?
Well, we talk about, since the election, the primary, that these are really contrasting, you know, or to the right, far right and far left, if you will. This is really an illustration. I don't know if these are far right or far left plans, but these are they're not in the center. You know, DeSantis is doing is, you know, what Jeb Bush began 20 years ago. In fact, Jeb has endorsed this plan. I wonder if I could just...
So it's just a continuation of Jeb Bush's plan.
And people were always curious, like, well, where does DeSantis even stay on education? So we hadn't heard a lot about where he is on state policy. But his press people put out, it says, it boosts classroom spending for students and teachers, expands choice, vocational and technical education, and holds the line on college tuition, all without raising taxes. Meanwhile, Andrew Gillum's plan calls for raising taxes by $1 billion. They want to make sure to get those contrasts in there. Andrew Gillum's plan to raise the corporate tax from 5.5% to 7.75% on corporations is probably the most dramatic policy proposal in this campaign.
So 2.25% increase.
Right. And he had a press conference this week in Tallahassee and he discussed the fact that he says that, you know, everybody's, you know, I'm a big tax spender liberal. He says no individuals are going to pay more on this income tax. And only 3%, he says, and that's the rumor we've heard, only 3% of corporations pay corporate taxes. I don't know if that's true or not. We also know that there's, I think, 200,000 that are LLCs, the state lists. But this is going to be one of the biggest issues going forward in terms of will they paint Andrew Gillum as the tax and spend liberal, and can he successfully sell this plan as being, again, pro-education, and it won't affect most people because it's a bold plan, no question about it.
So, Ione, it looks like, I mean, even if Gillum were elected governor, he'd have to deal most likely with a heavily Republican legislature. So even to get his ideas through the legislature, that would be a heavy lift.
It would be a heavy lift. Yeah. That's why we need to elect more Democrats to go to Tallahassee.
I think that's
we're working
a key
on that.
Question here, because he's got this bold idea. He's unlike most people. He's saying here's a plan to pay for it, but that plan is contingent on what we totally expect to be a Republican legislature going along with it, which that isn't going to happen.
So, Chris, could we see this then as a referendum on whether or not to pay teachers $50,000
a year to start? This is not a referendum about teachers or schools. This is the way it's going to be painted on the television and the advertisements and the pieces in your mailbox as we get closer to November. It's going to be about Andrew Gillum is a tax and spend Democrat, socialist, liberal, and Ron DeSantis is a conservative that is anti-schools and anti-teachers, and the voters are going to be left to decide based on, as Mitch alluded to, they're both very left, very white, right. They're both extremes in terms of their policy positions, and they're not really trying to do what, by all accounts, most would say that a candidate in a general election ought to be doing, which is running to the center. They've chosen not to on this issue. It's very interesting, I think.
And I think the big question, though, is do people want a continuation of Jeb Bush's education policies that they'd see under Ron DeSantis, or do they want to try something new?
Absolutely. I say one other thing that's interesting here is both of their plans ask for higher pay for teachers. They both want that to be something that happens, and I think you're seeing that in campaigns across down up and down the spectrum, that there's a recognition that Florida teachers need to get more money.
In recognition nationally, actually, right, with the school teachers in different states across the country, conservative states, well, they're protesting and striking.
Yeah, West Virginia, Oklahoma, yeah. Other states,
Arizona.
Where teachers
Arizona.
Have protested, Arizona. And in many cases been successful with
That's
conservative
correct.
Legislatures.
That's correct.
Yeah. And you can't strike here in Florida, teachers, so right. We haven't seen that.
All right, well, several times this week, Governor Scott's campaign stops were met with protests or they were canceled altogether.
Scott, who is running against Bill Nelson for a U.S. Senate seat, tried to hold a campaign event at a Venice restaurant, but he was hounded out by 100 protesters angry at his handling of the massive red tide outbreak. A campaign stop near Destin was canceled when a group of people gathered there who were protesting the beach access bill that the governor signed. A stop in Scott's hometown of Naples was dropped from his bus tour, and when he got to Orlando, he was met by people who disagreed with his stand on the environment. There, the governor engaged the protesters and said he agreed that everyone has a right to express their voice. The protest came as red tide hit Pinellas County hard and also moved on to the panhandle, with tons of fish killed and washing up on local shorelines, chasing away tourists and forcing some businesses to close.
So, Chris, let's start with you. Were those protesters righteous or were they rude?
Well, I'm not even sure they were real. You know, who was organizing this? This was not just a grassroots, let's wake up and I'll go out and protest the governor today. This was orchestrated. But look, Rick Scott is a candidate who was made for television, but he's not made for the grassroots. He's not made for reality. He's terrible out on the stump. He's the most scripted candidate that has probably ever walked the face of the Florida beaches. And he, when he's facing an opportunity or a situation where he has to be unscripted, he has trouble. And I think that's why they canceled all these, save for the latter ones when they started figuring out, hey, look, we got to respond to this. The optics of, you know, canceling all these events, particularly in your own backyard in Naples. I mean, Collier County is probably one of the most conservative states in the state of Florida. If you have to cancel events in your own backyard, that's not a good sign. But look, at the end of the day, what got Rick Scott to become the governor is going to be what gets him to become United States Senator, and that is his money, the deep pockets, and being advertising on television. Despite some of the bad votes that he had or that he signed, the HB 631, the beach ban bill, is a terrible piece of legislation. I'm angry about that, and I'm a conservative Republican. And if I saw Rick Scott today, I'd tell him so. And I actually even said it on my radio show. I might not vote for Rick Scott because of HB 631, because it just screams of everything that the Democrats, I think, falsely accused Republicans of being, as that being the elitist for the rich guy. This bill and the fact that he signs it, owns a $14 million mansion in Naples, just gives more power and credence to the false claims that the Democrats typically make.
Mm-hmm. Amy, what do you think?
I think that there's an unfortunate confluence of events going on for Rick Scott right now. He's got a terrible record on the environment. He's never been a very popular governor, and the state is awash in one of our greatest things is awash in a terrible red tide that's driving down all kinds of business and tourism, and it's a big problem. So this is unique that he had all these, he's having all these events and protesters. It was a debacle of a bus tour for the governor, and you know, he's doing some things and he's trying to make it happen, but I don't think it's going to be hard. He still is going to have to answer for a largely anti-environment record that he's had as governor.
Absolutely. Rick Scott is very vulnerable to the environment. And when, after 8 years, there's a report card coming up here, and because he wants to move on and be the U.S. Senator of this great state of Florida, this is an issue he is just going to be challenged on when it comes to cutting, you know, regulations, ZEP, South Florida Water Management District. Those are facts. The state used to have 350 monitoring sites and now down 115. DEP, 1,600 enforcement cases in 2010, 220 last year. That's the record. Mm-hmm. You can't run away from that.
Chris brought up this interesting point. Southwest Florida is really a strongly conservative area, reliably a Republican, pro-Republican area. Now, Chris's point is that these protesters weren't real. They were put up. But do you think that there's anger in Southwest Florida over Red Tide? And does Rick Scott get the blame?
I think he's earned the title Red Tide Rick. People have lost their jobs. Businesses have closed. Workers have gone home sick. That's another reason why businesses have closed. This has been a terrible, terrible, unfortunate situation for our economy and for people's jobs and their health, and I think that he's going to pay the price for that. I think it is a confluence of issues, and I think the tag Red Tide Rick is going to stick.
And now it's hitting the Panhandle Bay County, right? Another Republican county.
Right. And it's right off our shore here in Tampa Bay.
And going back to Amy's, the confluence of events, I think that's right, including people's misunderstanding about Red Tide. Red Tide is a naturally occurring phenomenon. It happens frequently, and there's nothing that really is man-made that has to do with Red Tide. But it came on the heels of all this video of the green algae problem stemming from the Everglades and from Lake Okeechobee that a lot of people are upset about, and with good reason. That is absolutely a result of bad policies, both at the state and the federal level. And Governor Rick Scott, he's been the steward of our state government for 8 years, and that's why he's getting some of the blame for that, as well as for Red Tide, which he had nothing to do with.
Well, Amy, let me ask you this. Red Tide does occur naturally, as Chris said, but some of the scientists are saying that it's the nutrients in the water, which is fertilizer in the water, that's a runoff from the land, including Lake Okeechobee, but also farms and lawns.
Septic tanks
that's causing this bloom to be worse.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of talk about what's made this worse. We had a story the other day about the pollution from the Mississippi River, that because of the loop current in the Gulf has allowed that to come down and sort of feed the red tide.
And that's all runoff from farms in the upper Midwest.
Right. Yeah. And that has allowed this red tide. And we should talk about red tide is totally a natural thing. It happens all the time. It usually doesn't last this long. Right. Like, this should have been gone way, way long ago. And the fact that we're dealing with this now in election season, it's a terrible optic for Rick Scott.
And that was my point, is it fair to blame Rick Scott for the length of this bloom? This bloom is longer, as Amy said, than ever, almost ever. I guess 10 years ago we had one this long,
which was not Rick Scott's fault.
Going back to the whole issue of nutrients and runoff, if you recall, in 2010, it was Governor-elect Rick Scott who pushed back and wrote a letter to the EPA saying that the new clean water standards were onerous for the state of Florida. And so I think he owns this record. You articulated very well the decrease in the monitoring sites and other examples. So I think he owns this problem.
So environment may be the number one or two issue, you think, in the race for U.S.
The economy's good.
Because of Bill Nelson. Bill Nelson has something to say. If you can look at Bill Nelson's record and ask what he's done, you can look at the environment and see some things, and it's a contrast point for him with Rick Scott.
Absolutely.
Nobody knows what Bill Nelson's done, but
we're gonna talk about that first.
But also look, the economy is doing well and has done well under Rick Scott. If the economy were not doing well, we'd be focused on the economy, and since the economy is doing well, people look for other things. Right, what's the next thing that's not going so well? And Rick Scott has to own that. I agree.
There was that story in the Times the other day that 36 counties, though, have a worse unemployment rate today than they did before the start of the Great Recession. So the rural counties are being left behind, but the big counties like Pinellas and Hillsborough and Miami-Dade, those are roaring. Well, the work ethic of both candidates for U.S. Senate was questioned this week. Here's the new Rick Scott ad attacking Bill Nelson.
I'm Rick Scott, and I approve this message.
Bill Nelson's been running for office in Florida since 1972. Can you name one thing he's done? I'll keep waiting. Bill Nelson votes his party line 89% of the time, and that's when he bothers to show up at all. Nelson skipped 45% of the hearings on national security. National security! Bill Nelson doesn't write laws. He doesn't even show up. Bill Nelson's chair is empty, even when he's in it.
Meantime, Governor Scott is fighting to keep his daily schedule a secret. On the work schedule that he does make public, there are frequently no events listed. An attorney in Tallahassee is suing to make Scott's complete schedule public. So far, the governor has been successful keeping his daily plans out of the public eye. The attorney wants a judge to impose a fine of $1,000 a day for every day the governor does not comply. In fighting the release, the governor put on the stand an FDLE agent who testified that releasing his schedule would reveal FDLE's surveillance techniques, procedures, and personnel, and would compromise the safety and the security of the governor.
All right, so Ione, that was a really tough ad against Bill Nelson. How do you defend it?
Well, you know, I think this is a lot like the ad that Governor Scott had about how many times Senator Nelson voted to increase the budget, and he took into account all the committee votes that are multiple. So I think this is cherry picking. I think this is extremely blown up. I tried to research this. I could not find this commercial last night, but I find it interesting that in 2017, Senator Nelson was rated 95th of all senators in terms of introducing bipartisan bills. And he was also rated the 10th most successful senator in getting legislation out of the committee, which is not easy, and to the floor for a vote. And very interesting, one of the bills that he did get out onto the floor was the harmful algae bloom and hypoxia research and control amendment of 2017, which specifically addresses the algae blooms that we are seeing. So I find this that Senator Nelson is working hard for the issues that are important to the residents of Florida, and that's clean air and water. So you don't get those ratings by not showing up.
All right, Chris, I'm going to give you last word
on
this.
Well, I would just say to that, you know, okay, I'm not going to challenge your numbers, but the fact is, if you ask 100 people on the street, what has Bill Nelson done? They'll say, oh, yeah, and he's the guy that went up in space. Yeah. They can't point to a single thing. And the things that, Ione, that you're bringing up that he's done that may be a positive, they're all process, and voters don't care about process.
What do you think about the governor's schedule? Is he working, or is he keeping something away from the public?
I don't think he's keep anything away. I can't explain Rick Scott. I wouldn't even begin to try to explain why he won't release his schedule. I think that is preposterous. But at the end of the day, that's process too. The only people that care about that are insiders in the media. The average voter could care less whether Rick Scott releases his public schedule.
You know, all these people running for governor and senator all have jobs, but Ron DeSantis at least quit his job. Give him credit for that.
All right. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to, Mitch?
Okay, one of the secret weapons, or maybe not so secret, when Andrew Gillum's getting 34% to win the Democratic gubernatorial primary, was Tom Steyer, the San Francisco philanthropist, who had over 60 people on the ground trying to get young people and people of color to vote. So this week he announced nationally he's going to give money, $1 million, to 13 cities to bring in the black vote, including in Daytona Beach and Tallahassee. Gillum's going to need all that support to get him over the top. Steyer may add more money. It's a secret weapon for him.
Ione, your other big story.
I think we need to pay attention to the Hillsborough County Board of Commission. They voted last night to put in the budget $6.5 million for affordable housing, but no plan on what to do with that. There are 105,000 families in Hillsborough County who are spending more than 50% of their income on housing. This is a growing, growing crisis, and I think we need to pay attention.
And Chris, your other big story?
The Deputy FBI Director and Deputy Attorney General talking about putting a wire on Mr. McCabe and going into his conversation with President Trump, discussing the 25th Amendment to remove the president from office by his cabinet, and the fact that Donald Trump has these folks basically conspiring against him who work under his employ effectively as the President of the United States. I think that we're going to see some changes, and I think that it's fully appropriate. I also saw that they tried to excuse some of the comments about the wire and the 25th Amendment as, oh, they were being sarcastic, and I'm wondering if they're going to accept that when President Trump says that some of the things that he's been caught saying on tape, well, he was just being sarcastic.
Amy, your other big story?
We got a story today on TampaBay.com and Sunday in the Tampa Bay Times about emails we got from Marion Hammer to the Department of Agriculture. Over 4 years, more than 300 emails that show she will email at any time of day, night, or weekend, and people will answer her immediately and do what she asks.
One of the most powerful people in the state, I guess. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for a great show. Thanks for watching Florida This Week.
That was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV, the PBS station in Tampa. My guests were two journalists, Amy Hollifield, who writes for the Tampa Bay Times, and Mitch Perry, who who writes for a new website called Florida Phoenix. Chris Ingram is a radio talk show host and a TV commentator. He was the Republican, and Ione Townsend is the chair of the Hillsborough Democratic Party. Those are my panelists. We've got a few emails in on the topics. You can send your email into the studio here. The address is dj@wmnf.org. The big story this hour is that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has headed to the White House expecting to be fired by President Trump. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. If you want to weigh in on anything you've heard here so far in the last half hour, you can email the studio, our address, dj@wmnf.org. Let's just take a few minutes and discuss this. President Trump is pledging his support for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, saying the sexual misconduct allegations against his choice are totally political. Trump at the UN today in New York declared that Kavanaugh is outstanding. He says, "I'm with him all the way." He spoke as Kavanaugh's nomination appeared in peril after the New Yorker magazine published the account of a second woman who says he exposed himself to her while they were students at Yale. The woman said Kavanaugh forced her to come in contact with his penis while both were inebriated at a party. His first accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, has said Kavanaugh assaulted her in high school. She says he covered her mouth and tried to remove her clothing. Ford and Kavanaugh are expected to testify on Thursday to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Kavanaugh has denied the allegations. Let's listen in on a part of an interview with the New Yorker writer who broke the story, Jane Mayer, along with Ronan Farrow, broke the story about the second accuser of Brett Kavanaugh. Listen into what she said this morning on MSNBC.
The chief Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, Jane Mayer, her new piece for the magazine, examines the impact of Russian interference and a powerful new case that it decided the election. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But first, we want to discuss, Jane, your latest reporting on the new allegation against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Give us, Jane, if you could, a little context around Ms. Ramirez's accusations. Reading deeper into it, we're hearing that she spent some time working to remember exactly what happened, and there's even some people who were, you know, helping her remember exactly who it was. Can you fill in the gaps here and explain her accusations' context?
Sure, thank you. It is actually my reporting partner on the story, co-author Ronan Farrow, who spoke with her, but she did spend 6 days trying to make sure that she remembered this clearly enough to want to come forward and put herself into the middle of this, a brawl, yeah, basically, politically. She spoke with classmates to try to remember, you know, talk to them about what they remembered. She had gaps in her memory, partly because it was very upsetting. And she also had been drinking at the time and wasn't sure whether this was the kind of image of herself she wanted to present. But in the end, she felt it was really important to come forward. And she, you know, I think what, you know, stepping back, so far the story is being defined to some extent by the White House, where there's a real imbalance of power. You've got the White House putting out its talking points, Kavanaugh's people putting out their talking points. You've got this woman who lives in Boulder, Colorado, who told her story to only one place, The New Yorker. And it's a small kind of megaphone compared to what she's up against here. And it's a scary thing to go up against this.
So can you give us a timeline, Jane, of when she decided to step forward? Had she been looking at the Kavanaugh hearings, and when did she decide to step forward? Or was it Dr. Ford's coming forward that made her decide that she'd step forward as well?
No, actually, she didn't step forward. This is the thing. We called her. We heard her name. This is a story. She did not ask for this. She felt once asked, she had to try to search her memory to really remember and say whether there was something here. But this wasn't her idea to come forward. What happened is that 35 years ago, when this incident took place, people talked about it. And people in that Yale class have been talking about it since then. And there is, I mean, everybody here has been talking this morning about how there's no corroboration. There's a very sober background source who was not part of the party, was not drunk, heard about it either that night, he thinks, or the next day. When I asked him myself, does he remember this, and is he sure that Kavanaugh was the person he heard about in this? He said to me, I am 100% sure. He's told, he's mentioned it to other people in grad school over the years. His classmates were talking about it in July before Christine Blasey Ford came forward. We've looked at the emails. They're chattering about it, saying, boy, if the FBI investigates him, there are going to be some stories here that are going to put an end to his nomination.
Right. So just to be clear, we're not asserting anything other than what the New York Times here. Let me read you a couple of New York Times quotes and see how it lines up with this New Yorker piece. The Times had interviewed several dozen people over the past week in an attempt to corroborate her story and could find no one with firsthand knowledge. Mr. Maris herself contacted former Yale classmates asking if they recalled the incident and told some of them that she could not be certain Mr. Kavanaugh was the one who exposed himself. That was the New York Times. Did she ever express any doubts to either you or Ronan that it was perhaps it was not Mr. Kavanaugh, Judge Kavanaugh?
To Ronan, she said she wasn't absolutely certain. She needed to make certain before she was going to say anything publicly. She remembered the specifics, the graphic specifics. It was very upsetting to her. And she tried to remember for sure who that man was who was in her face. And so it took her a while before she felt she was completely certain. Though I have to, you know, with all due respect to the New York Times, which is the best paper in America, just because they couldn't get the story and speak to her or to find the person that we found who remembered it from back then, it doesn't mean it's not true. You know, it's, and it doesn't, I'm at any rate, you know, I think
let me stop you there. So who is the New Yorker's corroborating witness? Because the Times says they couldn't find a corroborating witness. So somebody that was in the room at the time that it happened.
No, this is, as we say in the story, we spoke to the people who are alleged to have been in the room, and they kept saying things like either they didn't return the phone calls or they'd say, I can't remember. You know, and this is why I think her call for the FBI is a good idea, because sometimes something that people might say to a reporter is different from what they might say to an FBI officer
when
they're in danger of perjury charges. And I think it's a good idea. Yeah. Well, you know, it's a hard thing. We tried very hard to put across what we do know, what we don't know, what the crossfire of allegations are. It's all transparent in the story. But, you know, we tried to be completely forthright about it.
Right, and Jane, that's the thing. The way it's written and the way things unfold, you can tell there's a woman struggling to remember exactly what happened. There's nobody in the room that wants to go on the record and corroborate it, and yet this is something, according to the story, that was talked about at the time, that was emailed around after Judge Kavanaugh's name came up for the Supreme Court. And Casey Hunt, Jane's exactly right. And again, we don't know what the truth is. That's why we're saying there needs to be an FBI investigation. But people will say one thing to a reporter, they will say quite another to an FBI agent. And of course, the FBI, they are not the super cops. But they do, of course, have the ability to say, tell me the truth, or else you may be going to jail.
Well, and as special counsel Bob Mueller and the FBI agents working with him are busily demonstrating, if you lie to law enforcement, bad things happen. It is a bad plan. And I think everybody realizes that, you know, that's, it's more significant. I mean, obviously, I think, you know, when they're speaking with Jane, there's, you know, everybody wants to be honest in their conversations. But I certainly have a feeling I would be more careful and specific about recollections of any party I may or may not have attended in college. But Jane, I also wanted to ask you about something that's a little bit farther down in your story, but that I'm wondering may not, you know, be something that resurfaces over the course of the next few days. You report that you spoke to somebody about Mark Judge, who Dr. Ford alleges was the other person in the room when the assault, her assault, took place. And he is describing incidents with perhaps many women in the context of the Georgetown days. And I was just hoping you could kind of walk through what your reporting is on that and give us a little bit of context about why you thought that was important.
Okay. Well, so Mark Judge, as you say, is the other man. He was at the time a teenager who, according to Christine Blasey Ford, was in the room with her when she charges she was assaulted sexually by Brett Kavanaugh. So he's the pivotal witness, really, at this point. And what happened was I actually really received a call from Mark Judge's former girlfriend, college girlfriend, who said, and she's on the record here, her name is Elizabeth Razor, and she was at Catholic University with him, and she said, I feel a moral obligation to correct the record here. What he's saying about how there's no way that this could have happened because they only knew boys, they only roughhoused with boys, there were no girls, basically, in their lives. She said, Mark Judge told me that I don't want to say anything too scuzzy on television, but told me that he had sex when he was at Georgetown Prep with some of his friends, all with the same drunk woman at the same time. And she's saying this on the record, and she's a teacher now. And she said, I wouldn't betray confidences ordinarily, but I felt it was just too important, and I needed to say there's another picture of Georgetown Prep social life than the one that he, and he knows that.
That was a part of an interview this morning on MSNBC with Jane Mayer, the co-author of a new piece in the New Yorker about a second woman who's come forward about sexual allegations against Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee. So that is big news, and you can watch the entire interview on the MSNBC.com website. Just look for the Morning Joe show from this morning and see the entire interview. Well, and the other big news of this hour is that the firing of Rod Rosenstein, apparently. I'm going to read from a couple of sources. First, from the Associated Press, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein headed to the White House today expecting to be fired by President Trump. A person familiar with the situation told the Associated Press. Trump himself was in New York City for a meeting of the UN General Assembly. The development comes 3 days after news reports indicating that last year Rosenstein had raised the idea of secretly recording Trump and of invoking the Constitution to have his cabinet remove him from office. So that's the AP's report. I'm going to go to the New York Magazine story about this, and it has a few more details. This is, again, just reading from New York Magazine. Axios reported on Monday morning that Rod Rosenstein, the embattled deputy attorney general, has tendered his resignation to White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. The Washington Post and Bloomberg also reported that Rosenstein had quit, but multiple other sources said Rosenstein had been summoned to the White House where he was expected to be fired. So we don't know exactly how he's leaving. We haven't heard officially yet anything from the White House. Pete Williams at NBC reports that Rosenstein has said that if Trump wants him gone, they'll have to fire him, and that Rosenstein will refuse to resign and go quietly. The distinction is important because of the rules that kick in based on the manner of Rosenstein's ouster. Why? Well, fired versus resigned matters because the Federal Vacancies Reform Act gives Trump power to appoint an acting attorney general if it's a resignation. If he's fired, it's murkier. Rosenstein oversees special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. His job has been in jeopardy for months. But Friday's New York Times report that he discussed the possibility of wearing a wire to record incriminating statements made by Trump and invoking the 25th Amendment to remove the president seems to have sealed his fate. Rosenstein was expected to have to testify before Congress about those conversations. With Rosenstein out, it's not entirely clear authority over the Mueller probe is expected to fall to Solicitor General Noel Francisco, a Justice Department official told the Times. Okay, so we know that it looks like Rosenstein is about to either resign, quit, or be fired. He's about to quit or be fired, and that it really matters because if he resigns, then President Trump has the power to appoint an acting attorney general who would have then control over special counsel Mueller's investigation. Or if he's fired, well, then it's murkier, and Rosenstein might put up a fight and might try to stay in there. So what do you think about this? Rosenstein stepping down, how does it... How do you think it affects you? And our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And let's take some phone calls. 813-239-9663. Thanks to Frank Knox. He's our phone producer today. We're going to go to John in Port Richey. John, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, thanks for the show, Rob. First of all, I got a question. The New York Times article, did that use unnamed sources, or did they source their information on his statements about using the wire and the 26th Amendment? Do you remember that?
As I recall from Friday, it was unnamed sources. That's what I recall.
That's what I recall, yeah. So I find this interesting that the conservatives who hate the New York Times and call it fake news, and all the unnamed sources that they have that they use, it's all being fake news, is now pointing to this as actual factual news. So I just kind of think that's interesting, the hypocrisy there, that if it's against them, it's fake news, but if it's for them, it's real news.
All right, John. And anything else you'd like to comment about?
Well, one last thing. I think it was Mississippi was challenging the census questions because they argued that it was going to, counting undocumented aliens would hurt their state, and they pointed to the Constitution, and they said in there where it says that every person should be counted, which would be a literal reading of the Constitution. They're trying to do an interpretation of it, saying that, oh, no, that's not what the Founding Fathers meant. And once again, there's another hypocrisy on the conservative side where if the Constitution is enforced, we go by the letter of the word, the law. But if it's against us, we'll go with the interpretation, but we'll blame liberals for the interpretation.
No, that's a good point. All right, John, thanks a lot.
Thanks for your phone call.
The Constitution says every 10 years there should be a census and all persons residing in the state should be counted. It doesn't say citizens. And, we know that there was heavy migration to the U.S. back then. Plus, we know that people who were of African descent who were brought here as slaves were not thought to be full human beings, too. So it would be interesting to see if Mississippi, I hadn't read that story, but it would be interesting to see if Mississippi is trying to say now that if you're going to be counted in the census, you've got to count only citizens. Because when you go back to the history and the original intent, they were just counting all persons. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And Fredericks writes, it's Rosenstein, not Steen. I think I've been saying Rosenstein. I've heard both, but if somebody has a definitive, if somebody's related to Rod and they know how he pronounces this, let us know. 813-239-9663. Let's go to... Matt in Odessa. Matt, you're on. What would you like to say?
Well, I think it's funny that Trump uses the OJ defense.
Which is?
Since you have no evidence for your innocence, the only other option a criminal attorney has is to smear the accuser. Remember how they smeared Mark Furman that he was a racist and full of a racist plot to destroy OJ, and how they corrupt the L.A. Police Department was, how everything was just horribly handled, because that's their only option. And that's the same with Trump. His only option, since he has no evidence of his innocence, is to smear the police.
All right. Matt, thanks a lot. So you're saying that he's trying to smear Rosenstein or Rosenstein.
Oh, yeah. He has to smear everybody because a truly innocent man would stand up and say, look, investigate me. Here are my calendar. Here's who I spoke to. Here's everything. I want to prove my innocence. I have evidence to prove my innocence. But since he has no evidence, his only option is to smear his accusers. And that's what, same thing at OJ, his only option was to smear the accusers. And that's what every criminal defense attorney has told Trump, look, we got no evidence for your innocence. So our only 101 class criminal attorney 101 says, our only option is to smear the police.
All right.
Okay, let's go with it.
Matt, thanks a lot. Thanks for your comments. All right. How big a deal do you think it's going to be if Rosenstein or Rosenstein is actually fired? And whether or not Bob Mueller's job as the independent counsel looking into Russian meddling in the election, whether or not his job then becomes on the edge. How big of a deal do you think that is? 813-239-9663. Let's go to Jeff in Newport Richey. Jeff, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, I got a question about, this Brett Kavanaugh situation.
All right, go ahead. I don't have all the answers, but I can tell you where to maybe look. What's up?
Okay. Well, the FBI has investigated this man's background 6 times and never discovered that he's a serial molester.
Yeah, there are questions raised. We don't know whether or not these 2 women were contacted by the FBI, right. And we don't know whether or not John Judge was contacted by the FBI. I think that's a good question. If the FBI already talked with them, then I think you're right. The question, Kavanaugh is probably safe. But if it turns out that the FBI didn't talk to these 2 women and to this guy who was allegedly in the room with them during the alleged attack on Dr. Ford, then I would say the FBI didn't do a good job.
Agreed.
Yeah. All right. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rob.
All right. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. But we don't know. And frankly, I have not read the complete New Yorker article yet. Let's go to Nancy in St. Petersburg. Hi, Nancy. You're on WMNF.
Hi. This is just might show my own ignorance on things, but I would think that there would be a couple of avenues that could be explored to keep Rosenstein in place. And one of them, remember with the immigration or Islam, with keeping everybody of Islam faith out of the United States. And there were some federal judges that there was an injunction against that. Remember? Well, couldn't an injunction be placed against getting rid of Rosenstein because it might appear to be obstruction on the president's part?
That's a good question. I think the president has pretty broad powers to hire and fire members of his staff, including the attorney general's office. Go ahead.
All right, that was my other question, because in so many places we have a lot of things in place as far as difficulty getting rid of civil servants, for instance, and people who have. I don't know if he's considered a civil servant or not.
I think he's higher up than that. I think he's a political appointee, and he's not covered by civil service. That's my understanding. But again, this is all stuff that we should double check.
Wouldn't there be like harassment in the workplace? He's not being allowed to do his job, for instance. Even though he is an appointee?
I think if that avenue were available, I think it's being discussed by Rosenstein or Rosenstein supporters right now. If that happened, I think that, you know, you, obviously, if it were available as a protection of Rod Rosenstein, I'm sure they're discussing it in his camp right now.
I don't know. It may seem like something for the laity, so it wouldn't be for somebody, you know, higher up like that. So maybe it's overlooked. Who knows?
Yeah, well, no, I don't think if it is available to Rosenstein, I don't think they're overlooking it. We'll see. We'll see if he brings it up. And let's go to Rob in Madison Park. Hey, Rob, you're on WMNF.
Hey, Rob.
Hi.
Great show as usual.
Thank you.
If Rosenstein gets fired, I would view that as no less than a constitutional crisis. And I know that MoveOn.org has organized already to mobilize protesters across the United States in the event that Rosenstein is fired. And I would encourage listeners to hook up with Move On to be a part of that.
If Rosenstein is fired or if Mueller is fired?
Both.
Okay, so if either one's fired, then there's going to be demonstrations.
Yes, sir. And okay. I certainly would hope that would...
Rob?
Yes, ma'am. I certainly would hope that, if nothing else, would motivate our cowardly Congress to move forward with impeachment.
All right, Rob, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in. All right, so, and you can go to MoveOn.org, right, to find out when those demonstrations are going to be.
Yes, okay. Rob, they'll tell you where you can be and how it'll get mobilized.
All right, very good. Thanks, Rob. And let's go to Gino in Tampa. Gino, we just have 20 seconds. What would you like to say?
Two things. I came to the station last week. I put in for a volunteer also. And the third thing is that with Kavanaugh is that, yeah, I heard about the two ladies, but I heard there was a third, I thought I heard it was a third person who knew some of them about that party also, too. That's what I said. I heard that this morning. It was two women, and then there was a third person who knew something about.
Yeah, Gino, you might have missed the interview with Jay Mayer, but Jay Mayer says that there is a person who heard that Kavanaugh acted inappropriately at a party, but this person heard it a day later. They were 100% sure that they had heard it a day later. Yeah, and that's in the New Yorker article that just came out overnight. Gino, thanks a lot. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up, 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. Sean has a great show coming up next, a debate to Florida.